From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on the school bus, or rather, just off the bus, in Rochester. An eighth grade student was getting off the bus when he felt someone jump on his back. The boys tumbled to the ground, and their friends jumped in and separated them. Everyone went about their day. That afternoon, walking upstairs to class, the boy was approached by an assistant principal. They were pulling him out of class and suspending him for 5 days for what happened getting off the bus that morning. The eighth grade boy says he was shocked. He had never been suspended. He didn't want to fail a class. He spent a week out of class and no work was sent home for him to do. His parents went to school to pick up assignments, but there were none for him. He told his story to Citizen Action of New York and the Children's Agenda, who collaborated with other groups on a report about suspensions and the so-called school-to-prison pipeline. In the past 5 years, suspensions in the Rochester City School District are down nearly 40%. And the question is, what do advocates want next when it comes to discipline, suspensions, and more? On November 12th, that's a week from today, Citizen Action is hosting with other organizations a town hall about ending the school-to-prison pipeline. They'll also hold a panel discussion that includes organizers from Toronto who have been working on similar efforts. And let's welcome our guests this hour who are talking about this and more. Mercedes Phelan is lead organizer for Citizen Action of New York. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Evan. Always a pleasure.
Also with us is Eamon Scanlon, education policy analyst for the Children's Agenda. Welcome back to you.
Thanks for having me.
And Iman Abed is here. Iman is an NYCLU Genesee Valley chapter director. Welcome back to you as well.
Thank you, Evan.
And on the line with us is Thena Robinson Mock. Thena is a program officer for the Communities for Just Schools Fund, joining us from, I think, Toronto. Where are you, Thena?
Yes, I'm actually joining you from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Glad to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. I know you're traveling and you talk about these issues. And my understanding, Mercedes, is you're going to have some colleagues from Toronto here for the event next week. Yes?
Yeah, so we're really fortunate. We're going to be co-hosting this event with NYCLU, the Children's Agenda, and several other organizations. But the town hall itself is happening next Tuesday at 6:30 p.m. at Monroe High School.
Monroe High School next Tuesday, 6:30 p.m. And I'm going to ask all of you, if you can, to kind of just give me a sense for the broad outlines. Then we're going to get into the specifics on suspension rates, what works, what doesn't, what students are experiencing, what you think is realistic. And listeners, if you want to join the program, we can get your experience as well. But Mercedes, let me start with you. When people hear school-to-prison pipeline, how do you define it? And what do you hope comes out of next week's event?
Yeah, so it's a loaded question, I think. I don't know how to say that I would define it, but I think, you know, it's what it's really about is kids are being pushed out of the school system and into jails and prisons, et cetera. And there's a way to prevent that from happening. And we really need to really focus on that and do something about that, especially considering, you know, what's going on currently in our district. You know, you mentioned what is working, and I think that restorative practices is one of the things that has been working really well in our district since the new code of conduct was passed. You know, suspensions have gone down by 44%, and I think if we actually made it that a district-wide model, then we would see an even larger decrease in suspensions.
Okay, Eamon?
Yeah, and it's both the push out of kids that leads to limited options in life, and many high school dropouts end up in the criminal justice system. And then the other layer is the way we criminalize kids within schools. And that can be metal detectors, police in schools that we're going to talk about today, forms of surveillance. It's about where criminalization starts and really the impact it has on kids and their life outcomes.
Okay, Iman?
Yeah, I think the school-to-prison pipeline to me is about the methods and initiatives and programs that are in place to not help children succeed, but to rather further criminalize students that can lead them into the criminal justice system. So I would echo both what Eamon and Mercedes have already mentioned. And I'm sure we'll talk about that later into this program, but okay. What that actually is.
All right, Thena, how do you describe it? And tell me about the work that your organization's been doing.
Sure. So just also echoing what our previous speakers have said, the school-to-prison pipeline, we're looking at the ways in which law enforcement and punitive discipline are pushing young people out of schools. And one stat that really sticks out to me is that we have 1.6 million students who attend a school with a school police officer, but not a school counselor. So there's something wrong with that picture. There's something wrong with those numbers. The organization that I represent is Communities for Just Schools Fund, and we work nationally with organizations across the country who are working on these issues, who are working to bring equity to schools. And so we're really excited to be able to talk about that next Tuesday and also present some of the work of some organizers from Toronto who will share how they successfully were able to end police presence in their schools out of concerns of equity.
So a number of questions that our listeners may have about Rochester and then sort of the broader picture. And I mentioned at the outset that we have seen some change in just the last 5 years. I'm turning to the policy analyst, where my number's roughly right. I look at 2013 to 2018, and my quick math was almost a 40% drop in suspensions in Rochester. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. And I never want to oversell the numbers because we know there are issues with misreporting. But we believe those are genuine. And that's a huge shift. It really happened with new policies that address the use of discipline. They changed the code of conduct. We don't call it the new code of conduct anymore. It's been a few years. The code of conduct now really lays out alternatives to suspensions and how we become a more restorative district and address discipline in other ways.
And I mentioned right off the top the story that's included in the joint organizational report, just the anecdote, the story of T, the eighth grader, who describes, you know, literally just getting off the bus, kind of gets jumped, they get separated, he gets suspended. Not only does you know, if the story is accurate, I'm not questioning it, not only does that story open up questions about should he have been suspended or not, but also he's describing a situation where he has no homework sent home. His parents are trying to pick up assignments for him. They're being told there is none. And what I don't know is how common that scenario is, if that's an outlier, or if that's what happens when there is a suspension. Do we know the answer to that as best we can?
I mean, there are thousands of incidents still. Like, we have a huge reduction. You know, we're talking probably last year, I think, was about 7,000 or so. So the numbers are down from the 12,000 or so we saw a few years ago. But this still touches many children, and many children the farther you go up the grade scale. So kids in high school get suspended at very, very high rates still. So this is extremely common for middle schoolers and high schoolers. As much as 3 in 10 students at some grade levels still get suspended.
But what happens when they do? I mean, that's part of the question here, too, because, you know, a little bit later this hour, a number of our listeners who are I don't know if they're skeptical of the term school-to-prison pipeline, but they shared a piece written by a New York City teacher in which the teacher is pushing back that suspended students don't get home, at least in New York City. I mean, we'll talk about that coming up here. But, I mean, Eamon and Rochester, are we concerned that students who are suspended essentially lose touch with their schooling for a week or however long the suspension is?
We do. And you know, whether or not, I'm not going to say every incident happens this way. There's different outcomes. But if you don't suspend them, then they're in school and they're getting instructed. So we take out the middleman. We don't need to make a perfect suspension system. We need to reduce suspensions, and that's really where the focus needs to be. Anytime you're removing kids, they're only guaranteed really 2 hours of instruction or help a day. Per day, so it's always a worse educational experience and outcome and service for the student when they are removed from the classroom.
All right, so on that note then, one of the common questions over the years when we've talked about this issue is what should be the grounds for suspension versus what that is. The teacher who wrote in New York City, his name is Brian McGeever, and he had sort of a flippant remark about this because Bill de Blasio, as we know, ran for president for about an hour and a half, and he was touting a 50% drop in suspension rates. McGeever says suspensions are down for us 50%. Students committing outrageous conduct often stay in their regular classrooms now. Remember when cursing out a teacher was a very big deal? Well, now it's just Tuesday. That's McGeever in New York City, and he's saying you should get suspended for that. So let me ask all of you. I'll start with Mercedes. I mean, how do we view that societal question that some people have to say, well, that person should get thrown out of school or thrown out of class versus we have to approach this in a different way?
Yeah, so I think what's interesting about that is how are we looking at what we're considering, you know, when we're suspending these students, most of these teachers are white, and the children are, you know, of color. They're black, brown, and they're, and so there's that bias there that teachers already have. And so are they being suspended for something that, you know, if a white student was doing, that they wouldn't be suspending a student for color of? I'm sorry, the opposite. And so, you know, I think that that has to be like the general start of where we look at it from, because there's plenty of situations where that is the case, where, you know, if you have seen like push out, you know, the criminalization of black girls in school, et cetera, it's very heavily based on teacher bias. And I think that that needs to be strongly looked at before we get into why these suspensions are happening.
Okay. Iman?
Yeah, I think we need to take a closer look at how the biases of teachers and other district staff are incorporated into what is subject to a suspension. So I think as we're talking about things like disorderly conduct, how often are students of color in inner city schools, and in this case, Rochester City Schools, are getting suspended for something that may be addressed by not necessarily suspending a child, but, you know, through mediation of some sorts, that could really deter a child from failing and actually encourage them to not only address the behavior, but keep them in the school as well as, keep up with their academics. But we know that sometimes those encounters are very different in suburban schools. And so we need to acknowledge what sort of, what are we dealing with in regards to implicit bias? What are we talking about in regards to school diversity and how that impacts a child's likelihood of being suspended? And then what are these children actually getting suspended for? You know, are they incredibly low-level offenses like disorderly conduct? Are they getting suspended for school code, like dress violations? What are they getting suspended for? And so it's very clear, I believe, in the code of conduct as to what I think that not necessarily the new code of conduct, but what the latest code of conduct for the city school district is trying to show is that these children shouldn't be getting suspended for things like that. And so it's just making sure that those things are actually being implemented. And I, you know, and some of the data that Eamon has worked on kind of shows that. But I think it's just something that we're still working on as far as implementation goes to make sure that those things are actually happening.
Eamon, you want to add to that, please?
Yeah. And I want to kind of shift to the police in schools, because I know that's really what we came here to talk about it, and if we connect suspensions and police presence and criminalization, it's all about what is the best response for the child's welfare, and what are the instruments we're using to improve academic outcomes, social emotional outcomes for kids. And suspensions, the research is overwhelming and clear that it has very negative outcomes in terms of graduation rate, incarceration. Those can be doubled in terms of life outcomes if you just have one suspension in ninth grade. So we want to move to models and things that really support kids and aid them. And so the discussion here is really about what role do police have in schools, and what are interactions with law enforcement or the use of law enforcement within a school building? What effect does that have on kids? And are there other interventions that are appropriate for issues of safety, school behavior? You know, what can we move to that has the best evidence behind it?
Okay. Thina, on the national level, why don't you give me your perspective on how you see this issue in districts across the country?
Sure. And this allows me to kind of build on some of the comments Ari made, which is that we often find that students are both suspended and also arrested for infractions that are not even crimes at all. Often we're talking about behaviors that are normal adolescent behavior, for instance, if we're talking about high schoolers, for example, or middle schoolers, and these very vague and subjective classifications such as disrespect or defiance. Well, if anyone knows a 14-year-old, you know, this is where folks, young people are developing, they're learning how to, you know, interact in certain situations. And so to punish that behavior is a problem. And what we know nationally from the data is that it's not that white students behave, for instance, any better than black students, right? It's that they are punished more severely, more harshly. And so the racial bias kicks in when we are looking at how we are perceiving these behaviors, such as, again, disrespect and defiance. I think we ought to call into question why we have more police officers in our schools than guidance counselors, because often what we need in our schools are a trauma-informed response to any sort of acting out. We need to drill down further and figure out what that behavior is. And nationally, what we're seeing is that parents, young people want to see something different. They know that young people can't learn good behaviors if they are arrested and thrown in jail. What we know is that it's always going to be better to keep a young person inside of a school.
When it comes to officers in schools, let's hit that, because you're right, Eamon. I mean, that's a big part of this. And, you know, for parents listening now who might think, well, naturally, an officer in a school is going to mean a safer school. It's going to mean more order. Let me start with Mercedes here. How do we? Because you know you're an organizer.
Yeah.
You're a parent.
Yeah.
You think about all of these issues from a lot of different angles here. Officers in schools. How do you address that for people who are thinking, well, isn't that logically a good thing?
Yeah. So, you know, as an organizer, as a woman of color, I have myself had, you know, bad experiences with police officers. And so thinking about my child, who is now in elementary school, going to middle school and high school, and having to like go through metal detectors and having to, you know, be even in the presence of police when she, you know, has already had some experiences with them, that scares me a lot. It's not something that I want for my child. It's not something I want for other people's children. And I think, you know, I don't know the numbers on it, but those who, you know, would say that they feel safer, I'd like to know who those people are, because it seems that, you know, the most parents that I have conversations with, you know, have also had similar experiences with law enforcement themselves. Or I've heard people say, like, you know, when I was in school, it felt like a mini prison because I have to go through metal detectors, et cetera. And I've had parents who have said that their students have been, you know, mishandled by police officers in school. And so I think that, yeah, I'm not for it. But, you know, I think that this town hall is going to be a really great way to open up the discussion and get a dialogue about it going.
Let's ask all of our guests about it. Iman, how do you feel about officers in schools?
Yeah, I think with some of the youth and some of the parents that I've spoken to, I mean, in some cases there is a wide response to this, right? Now, I can't necessarily speak on behalf of those parents or students, but what we do know is there's a variety of ways in which these children are actually being criminalized from the moment they enter school to the moment that they leave to the moment that they're walking the streets. So I think one of the things that we want to try to do, as we also put an emphasis on positive school climate, is understanding how do we do that by investing less in SROs in schools, or actually almost coming to the point of removal as Toronto did, but to also take into consideration what forms of safety and what forms of building that positive school climate do parents and students actually want. I think we want to make sure that, and this is why the town hall is being done, is to make sure that we have a platform to engage community-wide response on this. And we'll have a panel from, you know, the perspective of educators, organizers, students, parents, who will actually discuss and share with us how they personally feel in regard to the system and how it stands, but to also gain responses from the audience around how they themselves have actually been impacted by the school to prison pipeline, and to gain from them the insight so that we can possibly push forward in a more effective manner that would help step away from this criminalization of youth. So I think in that case, we're really looking forward to it. And this is something that we highly encourage. Specifically, we highly encourage parents and students to attend. So we're hoping to see many people out next Tuesday.
Okay. Amen.
Yeah. And I'm a little bit older than Mercedes and Iman. And I only bring that up because I remember when police were introduced to my high school, you know, and that was related particularly to Columbine. There were other incidents. I know there's a different specific shooting in the city that led to instituting SROs in 1998. But it was in kind of that late 90s that people first started thinking that police needed to even have a role in schools. Most of the history of public education, police had no place in a school. So if we go back, this was a reaction to a fear of the active shooter, the very rare and very scary event. And you could make the case that, yeah, police officers are more prepared to deal with that than anybody else. But those events are very rare. And even when police are present, those events often are over within 5 minutes. The majority of events happen extremely quickly. Police are not often able to respond. Many active shooters commit suicide or run away. So you're talking about preparing for a very rare instance when most of the time, and I, you know, it'd be amazing if in our lifetime there's ever a moment where any of the police and SROs in the Rochester City School Districts actually engage with an active shooter. Most of their day-to-day interactions are revolving around fights, revolving around simple things that kids do. And that criminalizes behavior, as the panelists have talked about before, that doesn't have to be in the criminal justice system, that could be handled other ways. So we have to think about what are the functions of safety that a police officer takes on that could not be dealt with by another school personnel who is trained to deal with kids, not to deal with violence and be in much more heated and dangerous situations, because the people that we bring into schools, the skills that they have are going to manifest. And if you're a warrior, and I've heard police officers have told me this, you know, police are trained to be warriors. We don't need warriors around kids. We need counselors. We need social workers. We need people trained to work with young people and to deal with their unique problems.
Is this similar to the argument that departments that get grants for military-style gear, SWAT gear, heavy equipment, et cetera, are more likely to use it when they might not need to because they have it? Is that similar to that argument?
Yeah, I mean, it's all of the what are we equipping these people for? What are the people that we're hiring? What are we trying to build here? And if we're trying to build an inclusive and supportive environment, police's role are often to intervene in extreme situations and in conflict, and their tools are violence, restraining people, putting people in jail. Those are not the things that we really want to intervene with kids. So there are better alternatives, and just having police in school, and the studies have shown this, lead to more violent incidents, lead to more arrests in schools. Just having the presence of police officers leads to the criminalization of youth, and you would expect that. So if we want to decriminalize schools, we need a less of a role for police officers.
Okay, Athena, can you add to that?
Sure. I mean, one of the reasons I'm really excited about our Tuesday town hall event is that I think we'll be able to have a conversation about what safety really means. And often, you know, adding more police in schools, it comes out of this concern about safety. But as Eamon referenced, you know, a lot of this has been a knee-jerk reaction to the fears about a Columbine or a Parkland-like situation. But when I talk to, and in the work that I do, when we talk to young people about what makes them feel safe, they often talk about having trusted, authentic relationships with adults in the building, having a counselor, having someone who can listen to them, having someone who can identify unmet needs. They don't talk about handcuffs. They don't talk about armed guards walking their hallways. So I think this gives us an opportunity to reimagine and rethink safety. And we know that there are schools around the country who are doing this. They often tend to be in wealthier white communities where you will not find the overpresence of police. So I think we ought to look at why those disparities exist and why safety means one thing for a group of students and something for another.
Let me read an email from Nathan, who writes the following. He says, Evan, one job I had a few years ago was a substitute teacher in the Rochester City School District after I graduated from college. It was the worst job I ever had. The level of disrespect and acting out was out of control. I was assaulted by students, spit at, students wanting to fight me when I would send them out of the classroom. It was my worst couple of years work-wise. Full-time teachers would laugh and tell me that's nothing, and they get treated worse. Already we had suspensions not happening. How do you propose accountability of student actions if they can do whatever they want with no consequences? Ask many rank-and-file teachers in the city, and you will hear these concerns. Eamon, let me start with you. I know you've heard this before. Mm-hmm. Nathan's saying he's been there as a substitute. That's what he experienced. What would you say to Nathan?
So I would say we want consequences. We want improvement in behavior. We want good classroom management. We all want the same thing. It's about what's the best approach. And suspensions, police in schools, these have not shown evidence of reducing violence, creating better behaviors. They are failed strategies. There's lots and lots and lots of evidence that they are failed strategies. So if we want more safety, if we want more respect, we need to do things that have shown that they can actually create that, which is restorative practices, de-escalation techniques, better classroom management, the adequate personnel in counselors and mental health staff. There's evidence that those work. There's not evidence that police or the use of exclusionary discipline works.
And Eamon, let me follow up with you, and then I'll have our other guests jump in on this too. You know, it was not that long ago where we talked to School Board President Van White, who came on this program with Sheriff Todd Baxter, among others, advocating for military-style academy schools and saying that that level of discipline is maybe the other end of the spectrum from restorative practices, but they believe in its place it can work too. Do you?
I'm not going to speak to that model. I mean, I think if parents want that style of discipline, that's more a question of their choice. But that's not a model that you can replicate across every school. And
so, what you're looking for are standards and practices that can be really the standard.
Yeah.
School to school to school.
This
not a one-off military style school, et cetera.
No, and actually, if you want to go back to that specific case, the school that they're modeling off of is a school in Buffalo. And they have a really bad retention problem. Many kids drop out of that school because it doesn't work for them. So I think even the gold standard that I think Commissioner White is pointing to cannot seem to serve all the students that it's serving. So we have to think about every student, not just the kids who like those really structured environments.
Okay, Iman?
Yeah, I think I want to not necessarily just look at the way the educational system is set up and the police presence in schools, but for instance, why does the school-to-prison pipeline in inner-city schools continuously get perpetuated? And we need to talk about the levels of poverty that these children are also faced with and how that kind of plays in. I think right now we're probably nearing somewhere between 80 and 90% of those who are economically disadvantaged. Children are coming into school hungry. They may act out because of it. They're not necessarily receiving the proper support that they need if there aren't IAP plans. Making sure that those things and those factors are kind of taken into consideration, in which we need to understand when we're responding to children. We need to treat them like children. We don't need to treat them like adults. And we do that by, increasing. And I believe right now there's a budget increase around the SROs and to keep them in the school districts. And right now I think they have somewhere between 12 and 13 SRO officers, which has budgeted over a million, right? Maybe a million?
A million and a half.
But I think it's really important to start considering, you know, why are these children acting out? What's actually the problem? And that's, again, the focus around why so many community organizations came together to push forth for the code of conduct that is now implemented is to take those factors into consideration. And we can't keep using SROs as a default in responding to those circumstances. That's not going to get us anywhere. And when we look at juvenile facilities, children who are actually incarcerated right now, most of them actually come from, you know, school-based arrests. And I think that's really important to consider, again, what sort of a pipeline are we creating for ourselves? And what are we creating for our youth when we say to them, well, you know, this is not necessarily working out for you in the classroom, so your alternative is to be in jail? That's something that I don't think needs to happen, but we need to be more compassionate towards youth, because I just don't think that that's happening right now. But that needs to be followed up with the proper resources. And I don't think further investing in SROs or allocating more of our resources in a school that's already in flux in regards to spending around SROs and not support staff.
Mercedes?
Yeah, I just want to say, it was interesting that he used, the word respect. You know, for me personally, I think respect is something that is earned. It's also something that needs to go both ways. And if a student and the students in the classroom don't feel that you're respecting them and you're not even asking them, you know, hey, how is your day? What's going on at home? Is there something, you know, are you hungry? Like, you're not figuring out what's really going on that's causing this, you know, problem, as I do air quote, you know, what's causing these problems, then how are you really trying? What are you really trying to do to help them? It seems, again, for other teachers to be laughing about it, it's just creating this negative culture and creating a culture of just these students. Like, I'm not even gonna deal with it. I'm fed up, you know, et cetera. And I don't think that that's the way that teachers should be handling it. And again, I think there needs to, you know, be a level of respect for students, because these students are dealing with a lot outside of these schools that, you know, a lot of these teachers have never even thought of. And it's sad that, we can't comprehend why they may be acting in specific ways.
Okay. Athena, what would you say to Nathan, who wrote the email?
Yeah, I mean, I think what it lifts up is that, you know, we do see these kinds of comments a lot from educators, who are frustrated with the lack of support that they have inside of schools. And I think that when we, what to me, this the school discipline issue, the school to prison pipeline issue also underscores the ways in which our schools are underfunded and under-resourced, yet over-policed. And so often when you don't have, for instance, counselors, teachers, aides, the kind of supports that you need as a professional in the classroom, it becomes very easy to say, you know what, just please remove, you know, the disruption that's happening so that I can get on with it and move on. But what would it look like if we were to invest in, you know, both educators and also young people? I think school pushout and the ways in which we resource our schools goes hand in hand.
You're hearing Thena Robinson-Mock, who's a program officer for the Communities for Just Schools Fund, and she'll be here in Rochester 1 week from today. There is a town hall on the school-to-prison pipeline, trying to bring the entire community together next Tuesday night, 6:30 at Monroe High School, if you want to attend, and they'd love to see you there. So Thena will be here. Eamon Scanlon is here from the Children's Agenda, Mercedes Phelan from Citizen Action of New York, Iman Abed, who is here from the Genesee Valley, chapter director from the NYCLU. If you want to join the conversation, you can do that. And when we come back, we're going to get closer to their recommendations. We're going to talk more about what they do want to see change in Rochester schools, really in all schools, when we talk about fairness, discipline, suspension, and more. More with them next. Coming up in our second hour, on this election day, many voters are looking ahead to 2020, and there is new polling that suggests President Trump is in good position. He's in good position in swing states where the electoral votes will decide the election. And for Democrats, new polling indicates there is a generational divide. Can it be bridged within the party? We'll discuss it next hour. All right, some feedback rolling in. Let me hit some more of it here. Mark writes to us to say, Evan, the story you read about the boy who got off the bus in eighth grade says to me that it's not a suspension problem. It's how we suspend that is the problem. We need to make sure kids can pick up their homework and stay on top of their schoolwork, and it sounds like that's not always happening in Rochester. Okay, Mark, thank you for the email, and Eamon, I think it was you who said earlier that it's not a case where we want to make suspensions better. It's that you want to reduce the number of suspensions. That's what this teacher, Brian McGeever in New York City, was writing about when he wrote his op-ed regarding suspensions. But they do things, I think, a little bit differently. And so in New York City, he works in an ALC, an alternate learning center. The colloquial term, as he says in New York City, it's called a suspension school. So kids get suspended, they go there. And he says there are myths about this. He says this is actually a good way to suspend kids because they're still learning. He says there's a myth that suspended kids can't get an education. The notion of permanent expulsion, tossing a kid away until some noble educator rescues him, is the stuff of Hollywood teacher movies. It's not happening here. Here's how it actually works. When children are suspended, instead of reporting to their homeschools, they show up at an ALC, where they find an entire school community waiting for them. Guidance counselors, social workers, five major subjects, as well as online classes, restorative talk circles to help break the cycle of bad decision-making, and visiting speakers who grew up in the kids' neighborhoods. The stigma that school suspensions are the beginning of the end for a child is simply part of a continuous melodrama. Our kids can even call our school aide mom if they wish, and many do, end quote. So he's saying, you can do suspension better. You can create an alternative learning center, and he thinks it works. What do you say to that?
So if what he's describing is a very intensive support system for a child in crisis, you know, all for that. If we're just talking about long-term suspension generally across the country, the outcomes for that are extremely poor. And kids being removed from the classroom for long periods of time have even higher rates of failure than just for short-term suspensions. So I agree that, you know, having restorative circles, being able to talk to more counselors, that would be great. That could also be infused into regular schools and having a better tiered approach. The need for an alternative setting, it should only be in severe cases. And then it's really more of a question of what are the supports for the child, not should we be removing children.
Okay. Thena, what would you say to that?
I agree. I think that when we remove students from the regular school setting, I think that we are sending a message that student does not belong and that student can be discarded. And I do question why we can't work to have the same kinds of supports in the regular school setting. Restorative circles, all of the things you named, those are things that should be a part of the everyday public ed school experience. It should not be separate.
Well, and I have to also say there's a later part of McGeever's essay that I thought sort of tips the hand that he's not always arguing fairly, because he says that another myth is that students of color are targeted for suspension more often. He says there is a myth of systemic discrimination. Schools don't have the power to suspend students just on the basis of race or ethnicity. And I feel like saying to the guy, nobody's arguing that. What we're saying is students are suspended disproportionately along racial lines, and often, and we also know that school staffs are disproportionately filled by white people in every single district in every school. There's not one single exception.
Yeah.
And we know that that is true, and we've done the research here in Rochester and Monroe County in Western New York. And so it becomes a case of a teacher thinks, well, this is, I think at Mercedes, you said off the top here, maybe a student is behaving in a way, and you said, well, I'm just going to, this student is going to be suspended. You're not saying, hey, this, the black girl in the front row is getting suspended. You're saying the girl in the front row is being suspended because she threw something in class or said something I didn't like. But when you actually compile the numbers, it may not be because, hey, let's go suspend students of color. But that's what's happening. It's happening in Brighton and Rochester and Honey Falls and East Rochester and everywhere. I mean, that's actually a fact if you look at the numbers, right?
Right.
Yeah. And I think that, and also like what that, the feeling that the teacher is getting from this action happening, like what fear is being supposedly induced by the behavior is what's also causing the suspensions.
Well, So what we do then about staffing, let me read an email from Patrick, who says, how does your panel feel about cases where there are extreme behavioral misconduct, like bullying of fellow students or the bullying of teachers? Maybe that student can be paired with an adult all day that has a background in psychology and sociology and education that observes students all day long and guides the student through their day in a leadership role. Also, do we just need more adults in the classrooms and in the schools generally to observe and diffuse potential issues? Sometimes I do think teachers could use backup in the classroom, just kind of a peacekeeper of sorts, with a focus on creating a more positive classroom experience for all students. It's hard for a teacher to do all jobs effectively. We already ask too much of teachers and pay them too little, which leads to another question. How much are we willing to spend on education as a society? I believe the answer needs to be a lot more. So Patrick's view is that we need more personnel in general in schools. And he takes the case of a student who is bullying, saying maybe not even suspending right away, but assigning almost an individual support staff for at least periods of time, et cetera. And again, I'm not exactly sure the structure of what's already happening in those cases, but let me start with Thina on this. What would you say to Patrick, who's wondering about, do we need more people in general, more people with psychological backgrounds, more support staff, more observers, to try to head off problems and work with students who have exhibited behavior that might otherwise lead to a suspension?
Yes, well, I think we always need more resources in our public schools, but I don't want that to become the reason why we as adults can't change our outlook and our behaviors and our approaches towards students. Because I think often when we talk about public education, the issue of resources is always going to come up, and it can sometimes, maybe even unintentionally, be used as an excuse for why we can't do things differently. And I think it doesn't cost money, for instance, to be able to look at a young person through the lens of this is a young person in need of support, not in need of punishment, right? We have to really change and check our outlook and also look at the ways in which implicit bias, both implicit and explicit, are showing up in our schools. Those kinds of things don't necessarily cost money to do. And so I think, yes, we need more resources, and we also can change our outlook and the ways in which we are responding to young people without even spending a dime, right? It's really about our outlook and our willingness to look at young people as young people.
Well, speaking to the guy who is on the program a lot talking about spending of dimes, let's talk about within the current budget framework, and then we'll talk about what's more ideal. What do you make of Thina's point that we can't just say fund more, we can do better within the current framework?
Yeah, I mean, teachers always deserve every support that they can get, because they have a very important, very honorable job, and we need to make sure those supports are in place. When looking at the numbers across schools of incidents or suspensions, it varies quite a bit. And it's not tied specifically to dollars. It's really culture. It's really leadership and the policies that the principals disseminate and believe in, and the type of culture they build within a building. So I don't think you need a huge amount of you know, bodies or people on the ground to make a school culture better. It's always good to have that extra support, but it's really about an approach to teaching, about the types of interventions that you want to use. We want to have more restorative coaches and fully fund things like help zones and alternatives. We want to have those structures and supports in place, but those are not particularly expensive. Talking about maybe in total a couple million dollars across the whole budget. But again, people do it without that, and people have done it for many years in many places. So first of all, it's just the buy-in. Am I going to take a different approach than suspending kids? And then we can build around what are the right supports. Again, it shouldn't, just like Thina said, that shouldn't be a barrier to moving in a different direction and building a different culture.
Iman, what do you think?
I think Eamon said it all, as well as Thina. I think I just want to acknowledge that we just don't want to have to worry about those programs that are already in place and the further jeopardy of them as we're continuously talking about the spending, especially in regards to RCSD, right? We're hoping that those programs can stay there and sustain themselves in a way and make sure that they're properly staffed. Do we need more staffing in those programs? Do we need more of those programs in each of these schools? 100%. But we do also understand the financial restraints that we're dealing with, right? But I just don't think right now, do we want to put the emphasis on anything else but the programs that are already working? Because I think that's really important to recognize is that in order to make sure that we have a more successful school district, it means allowing children to actually want to be in the schools. It means wanting to keep those children succeeding. It means wanting to help the educators and the other staff wherever they can. And I think that's possible.
Do you want to add to that, Mercedes?
I think that everybody said it really well. You know, last year, our restorative practice was actually taken out of the budget originally for the school district. And that was, like, really upsetting because, again, that's one of the things that's been really working. And so, yeah, I think that's where funding comes in. We need to have money not only to keep the services that are working, but to enhance them. You know, we need more help zones throughout the district. We need it to be able to have those services so that we can become a restorative district. And so I think it's one of those both and.
But Eamon, you know, it wasn't more than, what, 5-6 weeks ago we were talking about the questions on budget gaps in Rochester and perceptions. And here's an email from a woman named Mary, I think sums up some of the skepticism now, which may be the after effect. Maybe public trust is being eroded because Mary says, how will we ever provide proper support services such as counselors, functioning IEPs, restorative services, when funding has been so poorly managed? Do you think that is a fair question, or do you think that that is specific to the recent events? And do you think the public is reacting to what they've heard this summer?
Well, you know, if I see a child drowning, I don't say, we never save kids that are drowning. I throw my hands up. I'm done. I'm walking away. You know, I jump in and I try to figure it out. Just because of misdeeds or dysfunction doesn't mean education is not a huge priority, especially for kids who are extremely vulnerable because of poverty and high rates of trauma in this community. We should be doing everything we can to make the school district better. And no matter what the warts are, no matter what the dysfunction or problems of the past are, it's about the kids. It's about the outcomes for those children. So I'm fully invested in making the budgeting process better. I completely understand that distrust, but it's not going to get better if people disengage or if we spend less money on education. That has a track record of decreasing outcomes, of making things harder, of putting more pressure on the system. So 100%, we need accountability. We need transparency. The Children's Agenda has called for that in the budgeting process. And all of that drills down to the children.
Looked to me like you had sort of a visceral response to that email, Mercedes. What did you think?
Well, then Eamon went and stole what I was going to say. But no, I mean, he was really on point. You know, I think nobody's saying that there isn't any type of dysfunction, but there needs to be accountability. And the accountability is on everybody that is in this community. You know, we're today's election day, you know, we're voting. Who you put on the school board is going
to... Everybody's voting, right?
Everybody better be voting.
Okay.
If you haven't not yet, you better go right now or I'm coming for you. But anyways, but who you put on the school board, you know, you should be watching how they vote on things because that's important. There does need to be more transparency, you know, in other districts, people vote on the budget for their district. And I think that's something that, you know, should be taken a look at. But there, yeah, basically everything Eamon said, I retweet that.
Ruth in Rochester on the phone. Go ahead, Ruth.
Hi, Evan. How are you?
Good.
My husband is a middle school special ed teacher in the city. And I think that a lot of people outside of the city or who don't have children in the city district don't really realize how hard these teachers are working. I mean, these teachers are standing on their heads for these kids with so little resources. I mean, he's got kids who are supposed to be, you know, their IEP is 812, and their funding is so bad that these kids are not only moved into 1211, they're combined with another 1211 class and have one teacher sometimes. And so just assuming that it's bias that's creating these problems or that teachers don't care. I mean, I know all of your panelists aren't saying that, but I think there is a sort of assumption that when kids are being suspended, that teachers don't care and they're just throwing them away. I don't think people understand how hard these teachers work, how much they love their kids, and how much they have to work against the system to really do everything they can for them.
Ruth, thank you. I appreciate that perspective. Can I ask Thina to weigh in first on what we heard from the phone call? Go ahead, Thina.
Sure. Yeah, and I really appreciate the comment and because I understand and as a person also who comes from a family of educators, how hard it is to do the job that we ask for teachers to do every day. And I think that, you know, when we look at suspension, what I hope and what I see from young people and parents, their calls across the country for what they want to see is that they want to see there to be better options and approaches to the ways in which we handle behaviors inside of schools. If suspensions are the only option, if school arrests are the only options for dealing with, you know, when a student might be in crisis or acting out or not focusing, then that's a problem. But if we are willing to explore what is working, which is keeping young people in school but providing them with supports, then we see better outcomes. We see much better outcomes. And I think it takes a lot. It takes our willingness to look at, for instance, the budgeting process. We're seeing across the country that people are getting more engaged in trying to figure out where are the dollars going. We know that educators and school professionals are not getting what they deserve. When those funds are in many ways misallocated to increased police in schools, then that's taking money away from the teaching force. That's taking money away from supports for young people in order to make our classrooms feel better. So, lots of understanding for what teachers are up against. And I know that our young people across the country deserve to have schools where they can feel supported and where they can remain inside of classrooms. So I know we can do it.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, and I'll just repeat again. Suspensions don't improve behavior for children. And so I completely sympathize because nothing is more challenging probably than being a special ed teacher in middle school, right? You think about being a middle school teacher is tough with all the hormones and the changes kids go through. But then you take on that with kids with special needs. It's an extremely challenging job. So ultimately, we need a really good special ed system in the city and across the country. We need the right supports in place. Suspensions don't really have a role in this. Every suspension is a failure because it's failing that student and it's causing harm and it's admitting we don't have a good intervention for this kid. We don't have a good support in place. So just go away. That's all a suspension really is. So I don't want to put this on the teacher. I just want to say that the tool is a bad tool. So let's find tools that work.
And so as we wrap up the hour here, the six recommendations from this multi-pronged report, we'll share the report, by the way, if you want to read it and read the recommendations, you got to check it out. We've essentially covered them in an organic conversation. And next Tuesday, if you want to join the conversation, the ongoing community dialogue, it's a town hall put on by these organizations we've been talking to today. And they're going to include their colleagues, including Thena Robinson-Mock from the Communities for Just Schools Fund. We'll see you in Rochester. And Thena, thank you for taking the time for the program today.
Thank you.
It is next Tuesday, the 12th of November, 6:30 p.m., Monroe High School, a town hall meeting on ending the school-to-prison pipeline. Iman Abid from the NYCLU Genesee Valley Chapter Director, thank you very much for being here, Iman.
Thank you, Evan.
Our thanks as well to Mercedes Phelan, Lead Organizer for Citizen Action of New York. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
And Eamon Scanlon is Education Policy Analyst for the Children's Agenda. As always, thank you, Eamon.
Thank you.
Short break. More connections coming up.